I would just like to ask each of you if you could please provide your opinion on the state of the criminal justice system in terms of its fairness to defendants regardless of race.
Good afternoon, and again, thank you very much for the work that you've done. My name is Darryl Roussan, the Senator for District 19, and welcome. You're sitting in my Senate district. I have a biased viewpoint when it comes to sentencing and fairness, and that is that the good news is that judges bring their humanity to the courtroom. And the bad news is that judges bring their humanity to the courtroom. And I understand that judges sentence, but in all fairness to judges, many of them are imposing sentences as opposed to giving sentences. And by that I mean probably 80% of sentences are plea bargains. They are arranged between the prosecution and the defense, and so to some extent, I think that's a little skewed. But what you discovered in your article has been around for a long time. April 6th of 2001, the St. Pete Times published a study that was done nationally that said that the black juvenile was 6 times more likely to receive harsher punishment at every step of the juvenile justice system than his white male counterpart. And they could have given the Urban League or the NAACP that $10 million they spent to discover that, and we could have told them that because we're living it. I think that, and to allow my colleagues on the panel time to talk, I'll pass the mic after saying this. We didn't do a lot this session when it came to criminal justice reform. I think Senator Brandis will tell you that we walked into the session with a high idealism, thinking that we could accomplish quite a bit, that the climate was ripe for this. But based on what failed and what didn't get through, we're going to be coming back at it next year.
I'm Jeff Brandis, State Senator from District 24, which is just north of here. It starts at 22nd Avenue and goes up to Seminole Margot, all the way out to the beaches. And honored to be with you today. I thought I'd talk a little bit about kind of my experience in criminal justice. I started sitting on a criminal justice committee about 3 years ago now. I'm not an attorney by trade, a Christian, but not an attorney. And so decided that sometimes this can be mutually exclusive. No, they're not. It's just joking. But coming at it from a layman's perspective, kind of the first time I'd had any experience of criminal justice, and sitting on this committee, hearing what was going on in the state of Florida's prison system, I felt like I was a plane at 30,000 feet with an engine out upside down and really nobody at the controls. As we looked around the system, we thought this is one of the areas of government that was most in crisis in Florida. And we can tell it's in crisis because it had 4 different secretaries of the Department of Correction in just 5 or 6 years. And so they had constant leadership change. We had all kinds of challenging issues with the prison system itself. We knew that the prison system was aging, so the facilities were older. In fact, in some of our facilities, they can't get pieces just to fix the gates. They were having manual guard sign-in and sign-out systems. And so an entire system that needed new, fresh eyes to look at it and a different way of thinking about criminal justice reform. So we embarked on a couple of different in-depth studies, and so one of the studies was just published. I thought I would just read a few of the key findings of that just to kind of frame some of the discussion for today. First, Florida imprisonment rate is 23% higher than the national average and 10th overall in the nation. In the last decade, Florida's violent and property crime rates and drug arrests have all dropped by approximately 30%, although the total crime rate remains 15% higher than the national average. Prison admissions declined 28% in the last decade, driven by declines in crime, as well as declining revocations for supervision from the Department of Corrections. Policy shifts in how violations are addressed. But in the same time period, average sentence length has increased 22%, balancing out the admissions declines and leading to mostly stable prison population. Trends in admission populations vary widely across the state. So not only is it Republican, Democrat, black, white, it's whether you live north, south, east, west. So in general, southern and eastern Florida counties send people to prison at a lower rate than northern, central, and western counties. Due to mandatory minimum sentences, sentence enhancement, and statutory time served requirements, prisoners in Florida serve significantly longer prison periods than in other states, including for nonviolent crimes. Longer sentences and fewer release options are the main driving force of the growth of the elderly population in Florida's prisons. And most Florida offenders leave prison with little or no post-release supervision. So once you've done your time, you walk out the door, you aren't on parole, you're just done. And so we have, over the last 30 years, under Republican leadership and Democrat leadership, the tendency has always been to enhance the punishments, to go from a misdemeanor to a felony, from a third-degree felony to a second-degree felony, to add additional enhancements. And that has created a situation where we have individuals who are serving longer and longer sentences, and there's no real proof that there's any societal benefit for these longer sentences. And because of the way that we've done it, we've structured it so when they finally leave the system, they're essentially just let out into the community with no real post-release supervision. So it is a broken system. It takes comprehensive reform to manage this system, I believe. I don't think it's one of these things where we can just go in and do one policy here, one policy there, and play whack-a-mole on public policy on prisons. It isn't that kind of a problem. This needs comprehensive reform. We need to look at this prison system before they go into prison. We need to look at sentencing, right? Because sentencing and diversion for mental health and addiction services, that has to be number one on the front end. We need to look at the prison system itself. We have individuals who come in reading at the fourth grade level, spend 5 years in the prison system, and leave reading at the fourth grade level. That is a problem. And then we have to do better on the back end. We have to do more support, more tutoring, more mentoring, more guidance on the back end as well. It is a comprehensive problem that requires comprehensive solutions to deal with. And nobody is talking about taking money out of education or healthcare, or nobody's going to. The legislature is not going to do it. Take money out of education or healthcare and spend it on prisons. We've got to find the money within the system to fix the system.
How do you go after two senators? I think that's the answer and question of the day. Good afternoon. My name is Glenn Gilzine. It is great to be back at St. Petersburg. I miss you guys a lot. I'm over in Orlando. I'm the new president and CEO of the Central Florida Urban League. And much of the topics that both senators have mentioned, I'm just going to slightly piggyback off of it because then we can go into the question and answer series. But what the Central Florida Urban League is doing as an affiliate of the National Urban League, we are one of the oldest civil rights organizations in the country, over 170 years old, with the premise of how do we help African Americans and other disadvantaged communities get access to services they need to be self-sufficient. As much of it was thought today or mentioned today, the two areas that are really of importance is prevention and intervention. One, how do we prevent young people or people of color or just anyone going into the criminal justice system? And the answer is education. And most of you know I was a school board member here in this list of my district at one time. And if we don't resolve the educational crisis that we're faced with, and I use that word correctly, then how can you really resolve the criminal justice system going forward? Then the next thing is, once they're in there, how do you bring back dignity to your fellow man? So in the Urban League and the Urban League movement, we don't even call them ex-felons anymore. We call them returning citizens. And it's all about how do we get them back on their feet, how do we get them self-sufficient. And throughout the conversation, I will share one of the things that the Urban League is doing is an initiative called the PEP model, Prison Entrepreneurship Model. And we're looking at ways of how to help individuals become self-sustaining through different activities and also working with corporate leaders, not using any government dollars, to connect returning citizens with members of our corporate America and also our business community, and giving them an opportunity, give them hope. So with that said, I'm just going to go ahead and pass it over. I just want to say thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks. Before I ask
my
next question, I just want to make a quick remark. Senator, you were talking about all the enhancements, you know, that are tacked onto crimes, and aren't most of those enhancements, like, weren't they passed by the legislature?
They were absolutely passed by the legislature. Over the last 30 years, you can find enhancements. And so, I said, with a Democrat administration, Republican administration, we've passed enhancements after enhancements after enhancements, on top of enhancements, right? Because
yeah.
It's never good enough to stay on the current hill. You got to take the next one. And so the enhancements have backed up, and I think that's what this report lays out, is because of these enhancements, because of the what we call sentence creep over time, we find ourselves where we have a declining crime rate, but a very stable prison population because of sentence enhancements, where we have people serving longer and longer sentences. We have 100,000 people in jail, and we haven't been able to see that number go down, even though the crime rate is decreasing, and we know that there are better solutions on the mental health front and on the addiction front.
So I'm wondering if maybe some action for upcoming legislative sessions might be a repeal of all those enhancements, or at least if we select enhancements, particularly like school zones, the zones where people get busted for drugs next to a school or a community center or a park, where if you look at most urban areas, if the whole thing is...
No, we have over 100 enhancements.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So I guess that leads me to my next question, and that would be, you know, what are some reforms that you guys tried to pass this past legislative session that failed, and why? And then what reforms do you propose? And I know that you obviously aren't in the legislature, but I'm still interested in hearing what some reforms would be from you as well.
Well, that's a very good question, and I'll take a stab at it first. There were several reforms that did not make it through the legislature this year. One of the bills that I filed dealt with changing the threshold for felonies. As you know, it's been $300 or more is a felony for the last 25 years. Well, this was before cell phones. And now if you just take somebody's cell phone, it's an automatic felony. We tried to raise that threshold to $1,000. But the retail industry, the Walmarts, the retail industry fought it, thinking that by raising it, it would create more opportunity for theft, not thinking about the effect of the felony on a person. Another thing that Senator Brandis and I both worked on, we've worked on for two sessions now, is driver's license suspension reform. We have 961 inmates in state prison for driving suspension arrests and prosecution, and we're spending untold amounts of money incarcerating them, and many of them for non-driving related offenses, and we tried to reform that. We don't think you should get your driver's license suspended if you write a bad check, or if you're truant, or those kinds of things, as opposed to something that's driving related. The last thing I'll mention is suspension of civil rights. We know that now, when you catch a felony and you're convicted of a felony, to get your rights restored, to have the opportunity to work in certain places, to vote, to otherwise participate in society after you've paid your debt and done your time, is severely hampered by the felonization. And Senator Brandis will agree that the easiest bill to pass in the legislature is an enhancement, something that creates a new felony. And these are attempts that we both made at reforming the system that ultimately failed.
Oh, can you briefly say what some reforms would be? I mean, I guess, would your proposed reforms for this upcoming session be the ones that you tried to pass?
Well, we have learned that sometimes progress and big policy change comes incrementally. And we're committed to trying again. At least I am.
Yeah. So I think, again, the number one thing that we're trying to do, we're going to do, is try to bring that holistic approach to looking at the entire criminal justice system, not just trying to do a whack-a-mole, hey, let's just do this one piece of policy, this, because this is going to fix it. It isn't. It isn't going to work, and it will take way too long to get done. You have to come in with a bipartisan group of legislators that have worked with the prosecutors, the public defenders, the sheriffs, the local police departments, the Urban League, to come up with a basket of solutions, basically best practices from around the country. So if you do one thing, do that, right? Put the people together. We had a task force bill this year that was aimed to do that. That didn't pass. We put money in the budget. We had to have $500,000 in the budget. to focus on that topic over the summer in administered funds so we could agree to what we do. That got vetoed, but we're undeterred. Right? I think that we know that these have to be solved. So I'll tell you some of the simple things that we can do are civil citations for adults and juveniles. Right? We know allowing adults and juveniles to have civil citations would be a first step at diversion. So let's look at things that are going to divert people from actually getting into the system at the front end. Addiction specialists, mental health, civil citations for those who maybe this was just their first time they were caught underage drinking, and instead of giving them a misdemeanor, we're going to give them a civil citation. I think simple things like raising the felony threshold. We have one of the lowest felony thresholds in the country. I think it's us and three other states that are below 500. Some states like Texas have moved it to $2,500 to be a felony. So I mean, if you steal a $300 item in Florida, you can go to jail for 5 years. Right? That doesn't seem right. It seems like we should be able to have a conversation about adjusting felony thresholds in the state. I'm not saying it's right to steal something for $300, but maybe 5 years is too much of an enhancement. And it's been $300 since 1983. When we went from $100 to $300. So it's time to have a conversation about those issues. But it's more than that, right? If we just do sentencing side, we're still failing. We need to fix the prison system. And in order to fix the prison system, we have to bring down populations so that we have resources to fix the system. So we need to do things that will have be specific to drive down the prison population, so that we have the resources that we can rededicate to the prison population. Things like more education. But then we need to have a conversation about incentives, so that we have incentives for prisoners aligned. Today, a prisoner can't even earn gain time, right? So go to education, until he's finished whatever mandatory minimum he has. And so for them, they have no incentive to participate in education, get a GED, good behavior. All of these things don't start kicking in until they've done 85% of their sentence. And so that creates all kinds of other problems. So we need to look at the overall incentive structure for the prisons. And then I think we need to go through the entire schedule and ask ourselves, what are other states doing? And is this sentence commensurate with the crime? Right? If you steal a turtle egg, it is a felony in Florida. Right, that doesn't seem right. We have lots of those types of things that we've just creeped over the years and done. But it's going to take a broad bipartisan coalition of legislators that are willing to have the courage and move together on this issue to get something done.
He answered it.
He answered for it? Okay. So all those sound like great efforts and great proposals. That hopefully and obviously would affect all defendants equally, but it still doesn't seem to get at the heart of what our findings were, and that is that black defendants are routinely sentenced to longer prison terms than white defendants for the same crimes. How do you propose addressing that discrepancy?
So one of the things that we did in Orlando is that we sat down with the chief judge of our Ninth Circuit, and we asked him to provide us the data after your report. And what we realized is, and most community members don't realize that of the sentencing guidelines, as you heard Senator Rusan say, and also Senator Brandis, that once you start a score sheet, and this is one of the things that we didn't realize either, was you can start a score sheet as a juvenile, and although nothing happens to you, quote unquote, in your juvenile, but that your record and those scores add on to your score sheet. So when you become 18. Then you get whacked with the entire book. We were understanding why did he get like 20 years for a simple minor misdemeanor? So as we started to unravel the data based on your report, we realized that one of the things that we had to do was figure out how do we educate the community on it. And because of the help of Chief Justice Lawton, our state attorney, and also our public defender, we started to go around the communities of all the African American churches and educating them on the discrepancy. And then we started to ask our legislatures, who one of our senators and these gentlemen's colleagues, who was actually the chair of the Criminal Justice committee, subcommittee in the Senate to actually take on this legislation and figure out how we can resolve it. But to answer your question, the way we approached it is we took the information and started to educate the community and creating a grassroots movement to get reform done.
So I'll just answer quickly two things. One, transparency, and two, education. Right. So you've got to be transparent about how these sentences are being done, and that includes the data behind the sentences on a per judge level. And then you need to be educating the judges, because they're human too, about where they fall versus their peers.
I agree with that which my colleagues have said, but I'd like to add that the problem is a little deeper than just at the judge and the prosecution level. And that is just recently, I had a conversation with a young African-American who feels like the system is stacked against him once he gets in and would rather do jail than do probation, would rather go and get locked up than thinking he can survive on probation by committing some technical violation and be sent to prison anyway. That's a problem. And trying to get them to understand that perception and not act on it is a problem. One other thing we see is treatment. There are certain populations more amenable to treatment and treatment more available to them than other populations. One example is, one year I had $150,000 put into the budget because I was told and I discovered that at West Care, right on MLK Street in the heart of the hood, of the 200 people there sentenced there to get clean or they go to jail, about 80% of them were white. Yet 70% of the defendants in the system were black. Why were whites getting more opportunities for drug treatment at West Care than African Americans? In fact, Judge Farnell didn't believe there was this disparity. Bernie McCabe didn't believe there was this disparity, but they were willing to take a look at it. But the governor vetoed the $150,000. So we never got a chance to look at it. So the problem's a little deeper, too.
Thank you. I understand we're going to open it up to Q&A now. Do I just call people? Okay. Ma'am in the white.
Hi, I'm Helen Riley, and my first one, so now we get one, I guess this is it. Where do Hispanics fall into that? Are they black? Are they white? Are they other? And are they not disproportionately incarcerated or charged at a higher level than are their white counterparts?
That's a great question. So the offender-based transaction system that we use for the majority of our reporting does not actually, they track race, but not ethnicity. And Hispanic is considered an ethnicity, so we didn't have that data available to us, unfortunately. But maybe one of these gentlemen know? No. Yes, sir?
Hi, Eric Gerard. I'm very clear on the discrepancies in sentencing. Have you done any studies, or have there been any studies at the state level as far as the restoration of civil rights? When these people come out, is there a discrepancy between black and restoration of civil rights, and what effect might that have downstream for their lives?
I don't know if there's any discrepancy on restoration of civil rights. Basically, in Florida, you have to apply, right? So everybody has to apply. I think there are, and I think one of the other challenging issues, and this is outside of your question, is licensure reform, right? So think about all of the occupations we have in the state of Florida. Well, if you're a former felon, you're not going to be able to get a license. You might have cut hair for 5 years as a barber inside the jail, but when you leave and you want to cut hair, you have to go get a license to do that, and you're not going to be able to get licensed. And we see that for almost every for many of the professions out there. So we need licensure reform as well as part of this discussion.
And part of the answer to that is Senator Audrey Gibson and State Representative Keone McGee filed a bill this year that would require the state to keep record and do data collection on sentencing disparities with the idea of coming back to the legislature and getting us to act on it. It's nice that the Sarasota Herald-Tribune pointed out the problem, But it would be great if we as a state acknowledged it and did our own data collection, but the bill never saw the day of the light of day.
Bob Millinger, public defender. When I started 40-some-odd years ago, a juvenile could not be moved into the adult system without a judge saying that child deserves under the statute to go. Now it's totally within the discretion of the state attorney. Last session and all the sessions before, when we tried to change direct file, the state attorney stood up and said, this is the worst of the worst. Those are who will be sentenced to prison, those juveniles that are the ones that are a threat to public safety. FSU study came out this week that showed 70% of the direct file juveniles get probation. If they were the worst of the worst, you wouldn't think 70% could be getting probation. So my question is, what can you do this session in this omnibus bill to fix the 20 people that have total discretion over whether a juvenile's life is basically ruined?
I think Senator Sun and I both support the modifications to direct file. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. I think it's really, look, I think the big challenge we have in the legislature right now is the Senate is actually very forward-thinking on criminal justice reform, and we're struggling Friday at House, our House of colleagues. And I don't mean to blame one or the other. It's just not how it works. That's not my intent. But every issue in the legislature requires a vision and a champion, right? Somebody has to carry the vision, and somebody has to be the champion on the issue. I think in the Senate right now, there's a vision, and there's a group of us that are champions on criminal justice reform that really have a passion for this subject, that see it as, you know, the Lord's work, if you will, to fix this issue. We just aren't finding that in our colleagues in the House, and we need a bipartisan coalition of House members to step up and say this is an issue we're willing to be passionate about.
I'm Irene Sullivan, and thanks for being here on a very important topic. My question for the two senators is, do you have any idea how much of the prison population is privatized, in other words, outsourced to private companies who make a profit on it? And after you answer that part of the question, don't you think that that drives up the problem, because the longer the sentences are, the more money those companies make?
I think there's approximately 7 or 8 private prisons in the state out of about 50. Yes, it's about money with many of the private prison population. The longer they stay, the other problem is cherry picking. Private prisons don't get the worst of the worst that are remaining back in the regular population of prisons. And I just want to mention briefly to Public Defender Dillinger's question also. Sometimes the prosecutors tell us as an excuse, and by the way, we both co-sponsored a bill that would create judicial review and not allow automatic discretion. But some of them say that the juvenile sanctions are not sufficient for some what we call prolific offenders. And we have some guys on the south side of St. Pete who've been arrested 14 times at 16 years old for auto theft. And to get their attention, sometimes adult sanctions are sought because they can put many more conditions on release as opposed to if they were in juvenile court. And I get it. There's a subset of hardcore juvenile offenders that we need to get their attention, and it's hard to do that in juvenile court when they know in 14 days or 21 days they're just going to get cut loose, or in 24 hours then they go out and steal another car within 48 hours. My car's been broken into 4 times in a fenced subdivision on the south side of St. Pete, and I don't know how we get their attention except certain adult sanctions.
And on the question of private prisons, I think you don't want to go to a public prison in Florida. If you go to prison in Florida, like a vast majority of our public prisons have no air conditioning. They were built, 40 years ago. They are falling apart, literally falling apart. And so the private prisons, at least they're better facilities. I mean, at least they're air-conditioned for the most part facilities. They do handle the lower-level offenders. That's generally their population is the lower-level offenders. And there's strangely more programming in there, a lot more programming than the public prisons right now. And I think that's the challenge is if I said that we had great public prisons and we wouldn't need another option or other ideas, well, we don't have great public prisons. Our public prisons are a mess. I have been to facilities where the senior person on staff has less than 3 years experience. Right? We can't keep prison guards. Our prison guards were paid, I mean, like $24,000. Like they were getting, it was either do I go work as a prison guard in this small town or do I go work at Walmart as a night stock clerk? That was the choice. We have a system that's in crisis, and it's in crisis all the way around. And so to the extent that we have at least some other options to divert individuals away from a horrible public system, then I'll support the system that we have.
Representative Newton, District 17, and I'll be that champion on the House side. I'm a freshman, so I look to you guys for your guidance and leadership. My question is, you talked about the point system, like the moderator did, as to where they can get scored at for a felony or whatever, how much time they get. Is there any way, with the separation of powers, that we can come up with a menu that says, if you get this many points, there's this much time, absent of race, creed, or whatever, that's all you would get. Is there any way we can work on something like that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much what we have today. The problem is, are you at the top end of the range or the bottom end of the range? And what we're seeing is the racial disparity. I think what the report would bear out is that the disparity is being sentenced at the top versus being sentenced at the bottom of the range.
And a couple of years ago, I actually filed a bill that passed and became law that decreased the number of sentence points to make you eligible, more eligible, widen the pool for drug court as opposed to incarceration.
May I add on to that?
Yeah.
So one of the things that we have to figure out is when they do this in the legislature is how do we also combat the recidivism rate? Basically, right now, according to Right on Crime, it's about 33% of people who leave the prison system return back. So that's when we hear Senator Brandis and Senator Russo talk about this component is in a state of crisis. How do you solve? You have to figure out a bigger picture of solving that problem, but also solving the recidivism rate as well.
I'm Tom. It seems to me, in a democratic society, people ought to have a stake in government and a say. So my question is: if you served your time and paid your debt to society, why should you be allowed to be a barber? And why should you be allowed to vote instead of having that scarlet letter placed on you for the rest of your lifetime?
Well, I think that's the conversation that's going on in the legislature right now. Obviously, there's a constitutional amendment being being discussed on that very issue as far as at least the restoration of rights. But I think there should be some restoration. There should be a time period of restoration of rights. But you heard Glenn Gilzean talk about recidivism, right? Two-thirds of your inmates are going to have some type of recidivism episode within 5 years. So what's the time frame? Is it, I just got out of jail for second-degree murder, and now I can vote and have the monopolistic power of a government behind me? Is that the answer, or is it some period where there has been no other incidents and your rights are automatically restored because there's been no other incidents since the time that you left prison? So I think that's all part of the discussion. On the licensure front, I think, again, that's something that's there's another time period piece to that where after 2 years, it's much less likely that you'll recidivate. And age has a lot to do with recidivism, too. I mean, we know that the most likely to recidivate are under 30, under 35. Your 65-year-olds, only 11% of them are recidivating. Right? I mean, anybody over about 60. As people get older, they're much less likely to get involved in those types of crimes. And so how do we look at those types of issues as well?
Joe Farrell. I've heard a lot of talk about the prisons, but our jails are also bursting with people who simply can't afford bail or 10% of bail, which Many states are looking at reforming the bail system. Is there anybody looking at that in Florida? Is that a good idea or what?
Again, no. I think you need a comprehensive review. I think if you're hearing one constant theme is nobody's saying, well, we've got this one section right. I don't think we've got juveniles right. I don't think we got addiction right. I don't think we got mental health right. I don't think we have jails right. I don't think we have prisons right. I don't think we have release right. I don't think we have pay right. I don't think we have incentives right. Right? That, I mean, and that's where the conversation has to go. It's not like we can fix just one little piece and leave the rest broken. You have to have a comprehensive discussion and the courage to have a comprehensive discussion in both the House and the Senate, and an AG that's going to support you, and sheriffs that are come on board, and prosecutors and public defenders that are going to be with you and help you through. Because if not, they're sniping all the way through session to try to kill the bill or to kill the bills. But what we've seen work in other states, Louisiana has done this, Texas has done this, is they've done comprehensive reform because they knew it was so difficult to do the one little issue here and the one little issue there.
And to piggyback off of that, as again, I'm putting up some statistics, Florida spends roughly about $53.34 per day, or $19,469 per year to house an inmate in Florida's prison, which turns into roughly $3 billion annually in our state overall corrections budget. $3 billion, that's a huge amount. And the senator's correct, you have to do comprehensive, you can't do a piecemeal, because if you do it that way, you're only swimming upstream, you're not solving the problem.
So following up on your little speech about private prisons, how do we justify paying companies to make a profit when our public prisons are a mess? And another part to that question, would you make a bet with me that there's disparity between who gets to be in the private prisons and who gets to be in the public prisons? My bet is that it's...
No, I wouldn't make that bet. Okay, Randis. He'll make the bet. The theory behind the private prison is cost. And the demonstration is how they can house, feed, clothe, medicate that inmate at a cheaper cost than government as a way of saving government dollars. And if they can't, then there's supposed to be penalties in the mix. But That's the only economic justification for private prisons.
Well, let me argue the other side of that coin. In Florida, healthcare in prisons was provided by the government. It did a horrible job. And so they ended up outsourcing that to the private industry. And they went for a competitive bid. And I'm not saying it's great. Healthcare in prison is not great. But the healthcare is done by the private side. The food service is done by the private side. The construction is done by the private side. The maintenance is done by the private side. All the equipment is managed by the private side. The technology that we use is all done by the private side. So what are we talking about in private prisons? Who hires the guards? Who's putting together the programming? That's really what we're talking about. Because everything else, even in the public facilities, private food service, private healthcare, private equipment, all of those things are being done by the private. So the question we're arguing about is who's getting paid to hire, train, and warehouse low-level offenders, because that's largely who's at the facilities that the private industries are managing. They're not managing stark correction, hardest of the hard, hardened killers. That isn't their population.
Jim Gillespie, how do you expect to reach the goals you have in mind and have articulated when you have sociologists saying that prosecutors and judges have implicit bias based on race? You have a public that's not really interested in and spending a lot of money on reforming the criminal justice system or the infrastructure. You have a media that glorifies crime. You have a media that reports crime even though declines are reported. People think and suffer fear because it's dramatized in the media on a constant daily basis. So my question is, you have a public atmosphere that is not conducive to what you're trying to do, even though several states, Louisiana and Texas, have made big steps.
Well, the first thing you do is you have to continue building relationships, and you have to continue showing people that it makes sense, C-E-N-T-S, to change a philosophy or a way of operating over a number of years. And you have to keep chipping away at the armor and the resistance. Then Representative Dennis Baxley, now Senator Dennis Baxley, and I drove 7 hours from Tallahassee to Angola, Louisiana, in a car and visited Angola Prison, which was once the most violent prison in the United States, over 6,000 inmates there, 10,000 inmates on 6,000 acres of land. But it was the most peaceful prison because they had changed the philosophy. Instead of having gangs, they had congregations. Instead of having gang leaders, they had pastors. And New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary built more steeples behind the wall than they did units. We tried to bring that concept back to Florida. It took us 2 years to convince, but we finally created a pilot project at, I think it's Hardy Institution where the pilot is. You build collaborative relationships, you show them that it makes sense, C-E-N-T-S, and you continue to chink away at it one session at a time. I'm on the Constitutional Revision Commission. Once in 20 years, every 20 years we meet. The bad news is there are only 3 Democrats of the 37 members of the commission. Sometimes principle follows a party affiliation. But we have to try hard and keep fighting for it.
I think what you're seeing is this is not, I would argue, not a Republican or Democrat issue. This transcends partisanship. I've been elected now since 2011, 2010. I don't think I've had one constituent walk in my door and say, can you reform prisons? Can you make that a priority? Like, it's jobs, insurance, education, and way down the list is prison reform, right? And so how do we our kind of overall criminal justice reform, right? So I think it really comes down to you have a handful of legislators who have found this and are passionate about this. And that's what you need. Like, I'll take that all day long. Give me a handful of champions in the legislative process and the willingness to go outside of the Florida box and talk about best practices around the country, and somebody who's willing to do comprehensive discussion. Legislators don't do criminal justice reform for a lot of reasons, but one of them is because constituents aren't asking for this, right? The closest prison to us is in Zephyr Hills, right? And it's largely the palliative care elderly. It's essentially a nursing home of a prison. Other than that, most of the prisons are in small towns up in the Panhandle or in small towns over near the Everglades. It isn't our experience to drive past a prison every day. And so it's not in our thinking, right? We want people to go away, and we want the people inside the prisons to fix them and send them back out as better people. But that's not happening. So we need to go visit some prisons. We need to go, let's go see what's going on there. Let's go walk through there. Let's go talk to people. Let's get our faith-based community engaged in this topic, because they're not, right? Let's go meet with them. Let's go talk to our friends at the Early League. But let's not make this a partisan issue at all, because it requires Republicans and Democrats and Libertarians and the Green Party all to work together to find a solution.
I want to make a quick comment as well, since you mentioned the media, and I know that the media is blamed a lot for dramatizing crime. Two notes on that. One, the media, nationally anyway, has long reported the decrease in crime, but actually, President Trump is the one who continues to insist that it's increased, despite statistics. And secondly, we've tried to do numerous stories on the problem in the criminal justice system. It's really hard to garner sympathy when you're writing about criminals, and it's really hard to expect our readers to care. Most of the reactions that we get is, it doesn't matter. It's their fault. They're the ones who put themselves in that place. So it's hard to talk about this type of thing. When people are arrested and sent to prison, they literally disappear. It's like they go behind a black curtain that none of us get to go behind. And so it's hard for people to know that it's happening and care that it's happening. I think that's what makes it hard for the media to report about it, and that's what makes it hard for you guys to fix it.
Now, the only thing I would add is look, the attack against us is you're being soft on crime. Right? You're being soft on crime, and therefore you're going to get hit in a primary for being soft on crime. And don't do that because you don't want that angle. So how do we change the narrative to be, we're not soft on crime, we're being smart on crime. We're looking around the country. We're trying to do the best practices. We're trying to look at what works. And I think that's what that's the narrative we've got to push.
And just to underscore Senator Brandis's point, he and I are diametrically opposed on many political philosophies.
One or two. One or two.
But there's two or three that we walk in lockstep on. And so I concentrate on those. And actually, Senator Brandis has become an ally in many respects on driver's license reform. We've got a few more hurdles, but I'm confident that we're going to tackle this issue and make it work.
Hi.
Question for Ms. Lacaz. We haven't heard from this panel, I wouldn't expect to, but did you get anybody offering a plausible explanation other than racism for the disparities that you all reported?
Sure. Well, like the gentleman mentioned earlier, implicit bias. None of us have made the claim, nor I don't think very many examples exist of explicit racism in the criminal justice system. If it does exist, it's very subconscious, the type of bias that all of us have just because we're raised in this culture. I spent a lot of time in Gainesville. I did a really deep dive into that community. And one of the things that surprised me was I went into that community fully expecting that blacks and whites, well, the statistics show blacks and whites use drugs at almost identical rates. So I really went in thinking I'm in a small pot on the college campus and I'm in a small pot on the black side of town. Well, I smelled no pot on the college campus, but I smelled a lot of it on the black side of town, which kind of angered me because it wasn't proving my thesis. But the point was, and a lot of people told me, from the police chief to the sheriff to some of the city councilmen, black people smoke in their cars more and outside more and white people don't, which kind of didn't make sense to me. And as a former college student, I know that white kids do smoke pot in their car. But I think one of the issues is that, at least in these really lower-income parts of town that happen to be populated primarily by blacks, is that it's not just that they've lost faith in the police, they've lost faith in the entire system, in the school system, in the city, in the politicians, in the police, in the healthcare system, to the point that it doesn't matter whether they follow the rules or not, they're not going to get ahead. So why bother following the rules? So if they get busted with pot once, it's not going to change their behavior. And that's an overgeneralization. We saw it. And I think that explains some of it. You do see black people getting arrested again and again and again. And so the system feels justified in throwing them away, or putting them away longer and longer and longer, when actually it's a much deeper cultural issue. And so to simplify things, we did put it at the feet of the judges because they're the only ones that can sentence defendants. But it's really all of our problems.
Hi, my name is Corey Adler. I work with employers almost every day talking about hiring former offenders. I'm really wondering your opinion of incentivizing employers to hire people so that they're not living in poverty and then acting out with bad behavior because they can't afford to feed their children. So what incentives do we have for employers to hire former offenders?
Well, I have worked hard with groups like PERC, Pinellas Sex Offender Reentry Coalition, to keep them funded. I've been successful in funding several reentry programs, the Tampa Bay Career Path Program, Bethel AME Ready for Work in Tallahassee, and PERC here. Part of that funding should help incentivize employers to hire ex-offenders, but also train ex-offenders who didn't get training while they were in when they come back home. We have a couple thousand inmates that return to the Tampa Bay area every year from state prison and are looking for work. So through those types of programs and the funding of them, that's an issue that I've tried to work on. And frankly, I've had the support of the Senate in doing that.
Again, when you leave prison, you're done, right? You're done with corrections. You're done with the criminal justice system. You're out on your own. We don't have parole in really in Florida. We haven't had it for decades, actually. So a couple of ideas that we've seen happen in other states are some type of like certified reentry program, right? You can go get a certified used car. You should be able to be a certified rehabilitated inmate if you've had a good behavior, if you've done things. So how do we kind of add that as a good housekeeping seal of approval on inmates as they come out of prison so that we know that we can separate them out from maybe some other inmates? Maybe we offer liability protection for employers who hire a certified rehabilitated inmate. Maybe we sponsor mentoring programs so that these thousands of people, maybe they're not watched over by the government anymore, but your church, my church, gets together and starts mentoring programs for prisoners and that are coming out of the system that want to be engaged and want to be involved, because we know if we tie them to a mentor, they're much less likely to recidivate. All of those things can take place. I think it's going to require the community to get its arms around this and be willing to have a conversation about the kind of what comes on at the end when they come out, right? Because we talked about a lot of diversion at the front end, what happens in the middle, and what goes on at the end. And I think that's the breadth of this discussion just shows you how hard it is for individual legislators just to get the arms around the edges to carry this issue.
So one of the things that we're doing on here, though, is we're working with our local career source. We're also working with the Disney Universal and providing opportunities there. The thing that we're running into roadblocks, and it's not in their domain, it's actually in the federal and the Congress, is housing. And because some of the apartments, affordable housing apartments in our market, says if you have any type of background, you can't live there. On top of it, in Orlando, we have apartment housing shortage. I think it's like 97% of all apartments are occupied. So we've created the system to help them become self-sufficient, but now we have to figure out, I'm going to Washington next week, and figure out how do we work with HUD and try to provide housing specifically for people who now have a job but can't go over, because once they fill out the application, they're going to be denied. So I think that's part of the piecemeal that we have to figure out as well.
Okay, that concludes the Q&A, and I'm just going to ask each one of you to wrap up.
Thank you for being here. I can't wait to come back home.
I think in our discussion today, you've heard about the breadth of the problem and how many challenging issues there are throughout the entire system. Right? It isn't fix this. We're going to run out of time. Senator Rusan's got 7 years left, right? He got an 8-year seat, so you got 7 years left. God willing, and the Greeks don't rise to get reelected. If I get reelected in 18, I'll have 5 years left to begin to work on this problem. But if we take it one issue at a year, we're going to run out of time, and then we'll have to find a new champion on this topic. So our focus is, let's do comprehensive reform. Let's put let's push for that outcome. We're going to have a new governor in 18. We're going to have a new legislature in 18. We're going to have some of us senators stay on who are passionate about this topic. And we need to be focused on educating our House colleagues and our constituents on this topic as well. It takes vision and a champion. We need to find vision and champion on criminal justice reform in the Florida House and the Florida Senate, and a governor who's open and willing to listen.
And we need to be smart on crime. smart on justice. We need to create opportunities for more treatment versus incarceration. And look at, while we've got bodies locked up, locking up their minds and their hearts at the same time. And then, remember reentry, restoration of rights, the opportunity to work. And I've had the guys come up to me on the street corners in Midtown, and they say, "Roussan, I got a felony. I can't find work. If I can't find work, I'm going to sling dope." And that's, and they're very open about it. We want to help them find work. And many of them do want to work. In closing, let me mention that I noticed in the medical marijuana bill that Moffitt was getting an appropriation to do research. University of Florida was getting an appropriation to do research. But I was able to stick in an amendment that allowed the flagship historically black college and university in the state known for research to get $10 from every identification card fee that a patient pays, which could mean millions of dollars to Florida A&M University, to research the impact of the unlawful use of marijuana in minority communities and the impact of medical marijuana so that people understand a prescription for cannabis that relieves suffering as opposed to a nickel bag on the street that will get you high. And we know that the statistics bear out that the African American is 7 to 10 times more arrested, prosecuted, and incarcerated for marijuana possession than his white counterpart. And hopefully this research will lead to some solutions.
We've come to the end of our luncheon presentation today from the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club, meeting today at the St. Petersburg, Florida Yacht Club. The subject, as you heard, was criminal justice reform with two state senators, Senators Brandis and Roussan, representative from the Urban League in Central Florida, and our journalist from south of the bridge. This program will be archived and available on TampaBayPodcast.com later this afternoon, as well as on TuneIn. Those of you listening today on TuneIn to the Radio St. Pete channel, stay tuned for further podcast content throughout the afternoon. We'll say goodbye to our TuneIn listeners at this time. And to our folks listening on Radio St. Pete, stay tuned for more of our local event coverage, today's hits, yesterday's favorites throughout the afternoon as we look ahead to the weekend. And tonight, 6 o'clock, our next live show on Radio St. Pete, our Friday night happy hour from Seminole, features our friends, the Marco Radio family, at 6 o'clock Eastern Time. One more broadcast of note that we do want to mention, our next mayoral forum will take place this coming Tuesday night. It is has a scheduled start at 6:30 Eastern Time. It will be live from St. Petersburg City Hall, and we will have the entire forum for you, moderated by the League of Women Voters, live on RadioSt.Pete.com. Again, that's this Tuesday evening at 6:30. So for now, this is Joe Bordeaux on behalf of the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club and RadioSt.Pete.com, wishing you a good afternoon and a good weekend from beautiful downtown St. Petersburg.